But before we begin, let us just very briefly give a backward glance over last week's lecture. Last week's lecture dealt, you probably remember, those of you who were here, with the origin and development of the Bodhisattva idea. And you may remember that we were not concerned on that occasion with historical, even doctrinal factors, development, etc., but rather with what we may describe as the deep, the underlying spiritual motivations which gave birth eventually to the Bodhisattva ideal in the course of the efflorescence of Buddhism, especially in India. We tried to point out last week that the Bodhisattva is in fact simply the ideal Buddhist. The Bodhisattva, as the very term itself means, as the very term suggests, the Bodhisattva is one who lives for the sake of spiritual enlightenment, who is one-pointed, who is concentrated, who has that goal, that objective, that ideal alone before his eyes, and whose total energies and interests are oriented in that direction, the realization of that supreme goal, that ultimate, that overarching goal of enlightenment. So we saw, therefore, that the Bodhisattva ideal was, in general, a statement, a broad statement, a succinct statement of the Buddhist ideal itself, the ideal of the attainment of enlightenment, Buddhahood, the ideal, to put it into slightly more modern terminology, the ideal of the higher evolution, of the evolution of humanity in the person of its most gifted sons and daughters, from an unenlightened to an enlightened state, a state of enlightened humanity, or Buddhahood. But we saw that the Bodhisattva ideal itself was at the same time rather more than that. We saw that the Bodhisattva was further defined as one who seeks to gain enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. Not just one who seeks to gain enlightenment. There's an amplification here. One who seeks to gain it for the sake of all sentient beings. So the question we saw arose, why the amplification? Why that qualification? Why that rider? For the sake of all sentient beings. And in pursuing and exploring this matter, we saw that after the parinirvana, after what we would call the death of the Buddha, which was simply the withdrawal of his physical form, amongst his disciples, especially his monastic disciples, there arose two parties. Two parties. One party was quite satisfied with the Buddha's verbal teaching. Four truths, the Eightfold Path, the Five Skandhas, the 12 Nidanas. They concentrated on this, and they thought, here is Buddhism. So they were satisfied with, they were contented with the verbal teaching. They identified this with Buddhism. They regarded this as constituting the whole of Buddhism, the teaching, the verbal teaching. But the other party, or rather the disciples who belonged to the other party, and they seem to have been in the majority, were not so satisfied. They, of course, accepted the verbal teaching. Now, they fully recognized the value and the importance of teachings like those of the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and the Five Skandhas, and the 12 Nidanas. But they felt that this was not all. They felt that Buddhism wasn't just the verbal teaching. They felt that it was rather more than that. They felt that the personal life, the personal example of the Buddha himself also entered into the question. They thought that these two should be taken into consideration in any formulation of the teaching. They considered, in other words, that what the Buddha personally was by virtue of his supreme spiritual attainment and what he did, these were at least as important as what he had actually said. And we summarized the matter, as it were, by saying that the verbal teaching of the Buddha gave expression to his wisdom, but his life, his enlightened life, an activity, gave expression to his love and to his compassion. And the second party among the disciples, the majority party, they contended that Buddhism comprises both of these together, that it comprises both the wisdom revealed in the teaching and the love revealed in the life. And it therefore also held that both were to be taken into consideration in the formulation of the spiritual ideal. And to underline this, as it were, to accentuate this, as it were, they said that the Bodhisattva, the ideal Buddhist, seeks to gain enlightenment, yes, by all means. This gives expression to the wisdom aspect of Buddhism. But they also said, in addition, that he seeks to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. And this gives expression to the compassion aspect of Buddhism. And in this way we see that the Bodhisattva ideal is a balanced ideal, a balanced spiritual ideal. It derived its inspiration not only from what the Buddha said, not only from the verbal teaching, but also from what he was and what he did. In other words, the Bodhisattva ideal incorporates, integrates both wisdom and compassion. And it was in this way, out of these considerations, out of these sort of spiritual stresses, that the Bodhisattva ideal, historically speaking, arose.